Welcome to Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders. You've done it all. You've walked the tightrope of success and accomplished so much in your career. Now what? How do you keep redefining your success and expanding your emotional well-being? Join us to hear talk on mindset, motivation, and your growth in handling the challenges you've experienced both in circumstances and with yourself as a leader. Welcome to Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders with your host, Tracy Crossley.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders. And today I have with me another accomplished leader, Coma, right? I said it right? Yes?
Yes.
Coma Kendi. Yes. Okay. Awesome. Welcome, Coma. I'm happy to have you here with me.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. So let me tell you guys a little bit about her and then we'll get started with our wonderful conversation. So she is the Vice President, Head of Curriculum at Code Academy. Coma leads and manages a diverse, high-functioning team that delivers best-in-class, interactive educational content in high-demand skills and technologies to a global learning community. Coma brings over two decades of experience in multiple industries to her current role, including leadership roles at EY and Morgan Stanley, where she led teams that delivered solutions integrating cutting-edge technology, new business processes, and industry best practices. In addition to her work in financial services, Coma has extensive business government experience gained from her time at the Cohen Group, where she advised domestic and international clients in the aerospace and defense industries, and her work in information securities with Booz Allen and Hamilton, where she advised Department of Defense and Department of the Navy clients on matters pertaining to information security and biometrics. In addition to her professional achievements, Coma is a highly accomplished rugby player and coach, and regularly coaches at high-level domestic and international rugby tournaments. Coma began her career as an officer in the U.S. Navy and attained the rank of Lieutenant Commander in the Navy Reserve. Coma received a BA from Harvard University and an MBA from Georgetown University McDonough School of Business and sits on several nonprofit boards. Thank you for joining me once again. So I have to ask, because I love your career path and I definitely want to delve into that. When you were a little girl, what did you want to be when you grew up?
An orthopedic surgeon.
Wow.
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I always had an interest in math and science, and I was fascinated by certain aspects of the healthcare profession. I remember reading, I think it was a book called Disease Detectives, which is all about epidemiology and solving, figuring out the root causes of mysterious diseases. But I was also an athlete. I was one of those kids that was always playing sports. So somehow later on, I think in my, I would say my junior high, high school years, I kind of thought about the medical profession, and orthopedic surgery always sounded like a pretty cool thing to do because you got to fix people and put them back together again. And of course, a lot of folks in athletics wind up seeing orthopedic surgeons, myself included. So that was what I thought I was going to be doing, which is absolutely not what I am doing. But for a while, I thought that the medical profession was my ultimate destination when I got to college and beyond.
What changed your mind from going into the medical field?
Advanced chemistry. But I think for me, I had always had an interest in things like international relations, in politics, and wound up switching my major from biology to government, which everywhere else is political science. But and really getting fascinated with solving other problems, understanding how different types of economies evolved, understanding how political systems could influence that. So I think that the common thread was I always liked solving puzzles, except for the fact that the puzzles I was solving were now not necessarily science related, but I did appreciate the discipline and the rigor of the scientific process, even though I did not wind up continuing on my trajectory of being a hard science major or of going to medical school.
So what was it? I mean, I get that you're a problem solver, like trying to find solutions, right? That's what drove you. I mean, and there's so many different industries or so many different areas that we can do that. Why was it interesting to you on a global level or a political level? Like, what was it about that that drew you in?
I think there are a few things. My family is both from the United States and from Sierra Leone. And growing up, understanding that there are different political systems, different economic systems that can influence human development was something that was keenly of interest, especially because I'm living in the United States, which of course has an abundance of opportunity and access to education, whereas Sierra Leone, though it has an incredibly robust and incredibly talented population, has just gotten a lot of the short end of the economic development and political development stick in terms of the challenges that that country has faced. So I think it was the awareness of knowing that living in the United States, there are a lot of amazing privileges that I was afforded just by virtue of being born here, and knowing not everybody in the world could enjoy those types of privileges. And that stuck with me. And I think that's a theme for me in terms of not just problem solving, but problem solving for good and mission-driven organizations. And even if in my professional life, I didn't have the opportunity to work for a specifically mission-driven organization, that's something that always kept me close to working with nonprofits in various capacities, because I always felt like there was a responsibility for me to use the good fortune, quite frankly, and the privilege that I do have to make sure that I am doing something actively to improve the lives of people who may not have been afforded those same opportunities.
I love that. I think that's great. And I think that, yeah, it's hard. I think sometimes when you have that, to not have it be what you do as your main job. But I also feel that when it's so important to you, you find ways to do it, like what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, and I was just going to say that it's also uniquely fulfilling, because there's just something inherently satisfying in being able to give back, whether it's volunteering locally or finding an organization that you believe in where you want to donate your money or your time, that it can make some of the things in life be brought into perspective. And I think it's also been something for me that just grounds me, that reminds me that, hey, if I'm having a bad day, there's probably plenty of people who are having worse days. So staying grounded and staying focused, and also just being constantly reminded that there are opportunities, little and big, to be able to give back.
Yeah, I think there are. I think it's just a matter of stepping up and doing it for most of us, right? And getting out of our normal, you know, day to day and going, wait a minute, I'm going to do something different. So going back, you joined the Navy. And what was the impetus to do that?
The short answer, which is the truth, is a direct mail marketing campaign. The longer answer is that I had a break between my junior year of high school and my summer job. And I received mailings from, it was, you know, that time when you're applying to colleges and everybody is sending you mail. And back then, I guess it's probably different today. But I got two pieces of mail, one from West Point and one from the Naval Academy. And both of them were running, I would say, they called them summer seminars, usually for people that they were targeting that potentially had high aptitude in math and science. But it was basically, come check out the Naval Academy or come check out West Point and see if you are interested in becoming an officer in the Army or the Navy. So I looked at the flyers, and West Point looked very gray. No offense to my Army brothers and sisters. And the Naval Academy looked gleaming and white. It was by the river and it was beautiful. And I thought, you know, I've got this week, so I'll go down to the Naval Academy, see what this is all about, and I'll come back and I'll start my summer job at the movie theater. And I went down there with absolutely no intention of joining the Navy or applying to the Naval Academy. And after that week of being exposed to a bite-sized slice of life of what it was like to be a midshipman at the United States Naval Academy, I came back and I told my parents, Mom, Dad, I want to be a naval officer, which was not in the plan. But to their credit, they were incredibly supportive, because they could see how focused I was, how intentional I was. And this wasn't just something that was a flash in the pan. This was something I really wanted to do. And through my exposure to the Naval Academy during that week, I wound up becoming a part of the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps and attending Harvard University. So that's really how it started. I think the Navy got the best return on investment for that bulk mailing flyer that it sent me, because had I not ever gone to the Naval Academy, I never would have thought about the opportunity to become a naval officer. And especially at that time, because it was around the time when women were starting to have more opportunities, that they were opening up more ships. And in fact, while I was in college, they lifted the combat moratorium, which meant that the ships that I could serve on had changed. And that was obviously an evolving process, but it was an opportunity for me that I never would have considered. And I am so glad that I went to the Naval Academy for that week and decided to join the ROTC and become a naval officer, because it was unparalleled, one of the best opportunities for leadership and management that a recent college graduate fresh out of college could ever ask for.
So I have two questions to that. Why is that one, you know, of the best opportunities? And also, what is a midshipman? Because you mentioned that.
Sure. So a midshipman is the name for someone who is an officer candidate who is attending either the United States Naval Academy or who is part of the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps. And that is a program that the Department of the Navy has with universities where students, while they're studying for their degree, they participate in mandatory classes and activities that lead to their ability to be commissioned as an ensign in the United States Navy or as a second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps. So there are other avenues to become an officer, but the two, I think, largest ones, if I'm not mistaken, are the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps, which allows you to attend a civilian university and fulfill the requirements to become an officer in the Navy, the Marine Corps, or going to a service academy like the United States Naval Academy, where you are immersed in a military environment for 4 years. And when you graduate, you're commissioned into the Navy or the Marine Corps. And as for why it was an incredible leadership experience, I think one of the things that I always appreciated about sports, I always played team sports. And when you join the Navy, you're really part of a team, whether it's a team that's a ship or a division within a ship or a smaller group of people, you are immediately put in a position of responsibility at a very young age and taught lessons about leadership that are extremely salient, because you are working with people, you are in challenging environments, you're away from home, you're working in dangerous situations where really the decisions that you're making can affect the health and welfare of the people that are that you're responsible for. And coming out of a place like Harvard, where obviously there's a lot of privilege, there's a lot of folks that may not have had the opportunity to experience people from different groups, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different races, religions, ethnicities, you're really thrust into a melting pot of the United States of America. And at a very young age, in my case, I was 21 or 22 years old, you're an officer and you're in charge of a group of people and you have stuff that has to get done. You have people that you're responsible for. You have to make sure that they're doing well in their careers, that they're doing well personally. And being at sea and having that type of responsibility is significant, because being away from home is stressful, but being away from home and helping people work through challenges they might be having, whether it's on the job or dealing with situations at home or making sure people have the career opportunities that they need, it's a pretty big responsibility for a 22 or 23 year old. And I know that my friends who had graduated and gone on to really great jobs weren't being entrusted with the operations of a warship or learning how to fight the ship in case there is a situation where there's significant damage done, or learning seamanship and navigation, because when you're on the bridge, you're responsible for making sure that everybody who is working and or sleeping and or doing whatever they need to do is able to do it safely. So I really appreciated that opportunity, not just as a woman, but also as a young person coming out of college, where I did not have that exposure or the opportunity to just interact with people from significantly different backgrounds.
I love that. And I can totally see what you're saying when it comes to that opportunity to learn leadership, because a lot of it could end up being life or death, depending on where your ship is headed, I would assume. So would you say you are as a leader? Like, what are some of the characteristics that you feel are strong in you, in, you know, in what you do as a leader? And do you feel that's where it came from? Do you feel that's inborn in you? Because, you know, there's always the question of, oh, were you born a leader or not a leader? But what about for you?
That's a really interesting question. If you asked my mother, she would probably tell you that I was born a leader. But I think that there are certain things that come from the expectation of leadership that then you have to figure out, how do you lead in your own authentic way? I think that people would describe me as being enthusiastic. I try to inject the opportunities I have for leadership with a lot of energy, with a lot of enthusiasm, with a lot of support. I try to invest in the teams that I lead, and that means getting to know people, understanding where they're from, what motivates them, what particular challenges they may have, things like that. So I get to know them as people, not just people who are on my team, or in the case of the Navy, people who might be in my division or my department. So it's really investing in getting to know the unique construction of the team that I'm leading, to figure out how best I can motivate them, and then how can I identify places where they might need help. I've always thought that being an empathetic leader is important, and I think that nowhere was this illustrated more specifically than dealing with an unprecedented global pandemic, where all of a sudden the touch points that we might normally have felt like we had, lunch or grabbing a coffee, that all disappeared for a while. And then we had to figure out, how do we lead in an environment where I can't just sit down with someone and say, are you having a bad day? Do you want to go talk about it? For me, it really is about looking at leadership as a privilege, and I'm there to serve my team. And the way that I am able to invest in my team, we can all grow together. And every team that I have led has taught me something. And I think that leadership is a continuum of learning. It's not just one leadership style and then you stick to it. I think good leaders have to evolve and adapt with the teams that they lead and the people that they lead. And I've definitely tried to do that throughout my career, and take my lumps when I haven't done something where I have perhaps inadvertently created the perception of something, or perhaps someone read the fact that I was having a bad day as I'm upset with them. Really being conscious about how I show up and how I lead and how I interact with the teams that I lead has forced me to look at myself and say, am I doing my best? And am I able to bring myself to the table every day?
I love that. And so what would you say have been some of your greatest challenges, or one of your greatest challenges as a leader?
The form that immediately comes to mind is when I was commissioned as an officer in the Navy. And I mentioned that it was when opportunities were emerging for women based on previous exclusions because these sort of ships or other particular commands were deemed to be combatant, where they didn't want women serving. When they lifted that combat moratorium and started integrating women into these previously closed jobs, when I went to my ship, I was the first woman to be permanently stationed aboard that ship in that ship's history. And that ship, when I showed up, was about 20 something years old. So imagine a group of men who had only gone to sea with, only served for men. And here I show up, all 22 years old, fresh out of Harvard University, and I've got 2 years to spend on this ship. It was an extremely challenging situation because I felt like I was under a microscope. Because not only was I just a new naval officer, because every young officer knows that they don't know very much, and you might have learned things in your school or things like that, but there's no substitute for actually you're on the ship and you're doing a thing. It was knowing that for many of them, I was the first woman that they ever worked for. I was the first woman they'd ever gone to sea with. I was the first woman that they'd ever seen, perhaps, maybe they'd seen other women in officer uniforms, but certainly not shipboard, not a surface warfare officer. And my job was to go there and learn all the things I needed to learn and qualify as a surface warfare officer and receive the insignia that I would wear on my uniform that says, I am a qualified surface warfare officer and I've learned everything that I need to know to be able to sort of start my journey in this field. And it was lonely because there were some folks that were happy to see me. There were some folks who were indifferent and some folks that were hostile. And mm-hmm. I can remember times walking into spaces where people would immediately stop talking because they were afraid that they were going to say something to offend me. And then all of a sudden they were going to be written up or sent to go see the captain because they said something that upset the female officer. But I think throughout that experience, I learned that I need to believe in myself and I need to believe in my capabilities and lean on people who can support me. And after that initial 6 months where I did feel like I was lonely, when I left that ship 2 years later, I was genuinely sad to leave. I was sad to leave the family that I had built and the family that I had discovered. Now, I didn't change everybody's minds because I'm sure there were some folks who are, oh, women don't, we shouldn't be on ships. Women shouldn't be here. That's fine because there's always going to be those folks. But It taught me a lesson about resilience and perseverance and really believing that I could do more than I thought I was capable of. And even though it was a very rough experience at first, I am thankful that I did experience it because it did shape the foundation for the type of leadership that I hope that I can give to other people.
I love that. And that takes perseverance, that takes grit. I mean, really, a lot of people, you know, a female walking in and being the only one after this, you know, you're the first one on this ship after the ship's been around for 20 years. I mean, a lot of women, and I think men, if it would have been, well, maybe not men in the opposing, if it was a ship full of women, but, you know, they might have liked that. But seriously, that takes a lot, especially at such a young age, that builds character. So did you stay in the Navy very long? I don't think we read that.
So I did 5 years in active duty. I got recalled. I did my first tour for 4 years, and then I got recalled during the beginning of the Iraq War back in 2003. And I spent 9 years in the reserve. So I didn't make the full 20 of active and reserve component, but I was in for a long enough time to have seen a lot of wonderful changes in the Navy in terms of opportunities that opened up for women and continue to open up for women to serve.
And then you decided after this, you went ahead and obviously went into a civilian position. And what were you looking for? You know, obviously there's a difference if you're deciding to leave the naval life for a civilian life. Like, what were you looking for in terms of your next position in leadership?
I still really loved the Navy, which is why I stayed in the reserves after I completed my active duty time. I still wanted to be in a position where I felt like I was supporting and giving back. So I think that's why it was easy to go to a Booz Allen Hamilton, because they're so integrated with a lot of the things that the Department of the Navy was doing at that time that I felt like I was adjacent to. I was trying to make positive changes. I was trying to leverage my experience to be able to do good things. But I also wanted to stay in a role that would continuously give me the opportunity to sort of merge my interest in technology with solving problems. So that's why it was very easy for me to transition, because a lot of the work I was doing had to do with understanding naval systems, understanding technology, and trying to solve specific problems. Some of them were very specific to the Department of Defense. Later on, perhaps they were specific to finance, but I was really looking to always have that problem-solving aspect, because what folks may not realize is even though ships have all kinds of systems and protocols and procedures, you're always solving problems. Something always happens. Mm-hmm. Something breaks. Something doesn't go right. You're always working with the team to solve problems and figure out what you need to do and get it done. And that's something that I really appreciated about being in a team-oriented environment that was always chock full of challenges.
I love that. So switching the subject a little bit, there's a statistic that reads 21% of the CEOs in the United States are female, which leaves quite a few that aren't female. So do you have any, I don't want to say an opinion because I think we all have opinions about it, but what would you say to that? And what would you say, you know, how can we improve that? Not, well, let's just hire more women, or, you know, let's get some more women leaders in there, because that's not really solving the problem. But what would you say your perspective is on that?
I think that unfortunately, very often, the more senior you go in organizations, the more likely it is that the people who are controlling access to those very senior positions are looking for folks who remind them of themselves. And if you have people who are, let's say, not looking for women or don't realize that they have amazingly talented women, they may go with what is comfortable rather than what might be the better choice for leadership. That's a difficult situation in the sense that I think that we need to figure out how to provide women with more sponsors and mentors. And you know, the sponsors always think it's explained to me, or a nice way to look at it, a sponsor who will mention your name in a room when you're not there. And how do we get more people in positions of authority, in this case, the percentage that are men, to make sure that they're widening their net, that they're casting for top-notch positions, for opportunities to shine, and make sure that there are women in them. And that it may be easy to mentor the person that might remind you of yourself, but what about the person that doesn't, who also need of mentoring? I mean, in terms of this, the, you know, there's statistics that talk about the difficulty of Black women finding sponsors and mentors and how difficult it is, because if there's a significant number of, let's say, white men in leadership, you're not white, you're not a man. So that's two strikes for people who may be looking for people who are more like them and might overlook the fact that, hey, you've got some really amazing women of color who could contribute to the organization in the senior leadership role, but you don't necessarily reach out to make sure that they get represented or they get opportunities. So I think there's a lot of conversations that have to take place, honest ones, especially at senior levels of the organization, to say, are you really looking widely, are you looking for the widest group of people? And does that include people who may not be exactly like you, whether it's in terms of academic pedigree or companies that you've worked for or roles that you've had? Because these people can also bring significant leadership to the table, but you're not inviting them to the table. Or if they're at the table, do they have a seat? So those are the things that I think about when you provide that statistic.
Yeah, I think about those things too. But I also go to women suffer from self-doubt to varying degrees, right? So they may not even put themselves in a position to have the conversations with those people that would get them, let's say, their name said or something to create, you know, to create that change. So, you know, when it comes to self-doubt, and I think most human beings have it, but women in particular, a lot of it comes from, you know, bias that we take outside of us and then we put in our brain unconsciously. So what would you say to that, you know, when it comes to the self-doubt aspect?
I think acknowledging it is important, that everybody has some variation of imposter syndrome where they might think, do they know that I'm here? Do they know that am I really here? Am I supposed to be in this seat? Is everybody looking at me? Do they know that I'm not supposed to be in this seat? But acknowledging it doesn't mean that you have to listen to it, that you know that it's there, but surround yourself with a group of, I don't know, hype women that can remind you when you have that imposter syndrome, like, I'm not sure if I should apply for this job. You know what, they'll text back, apply for the job. I'm not sure if my resume really, you know what, give me your resume. This doesn't shout out all the accomplishments that you've made. I'm not really sure. I mean, they told me, they offered me the job. Am I ready for it? Yes, you're ready for it. So I try to be that for my friends. I try to have friends who'll be that for me, but I think it's so important. I know it's been termed as you have your own personal board of directors or your own, find those people, maybe they're not all women, but find those people that when you start to wobble and have those thoughts, they will remind you of your awesomeness so that you can go out there and sit for that interview, revise that resume to make it 100% apparent the impact that you've made. When that job gets offered, that you negotiate for a higher salary because you know that the first thing they're going to throw out isn't what actually you can get for that job. So those are the things that I think I learned late in my career, because I know that imposter syndrome and self-doubt probably held me back from pursuing opportunities where I was well-suited and well-qualified to go after them. But I now I have that, you know, that little hype squad that whenever I even feel that way, they tell me, Coma, you know what, just go out there and do it. So I think that's very important for anybody to have, but especially women, because we definitely need to have people in our corner that are our personal cheerleading squad that always remind you that, yes, you can do it. Yes, you're qualified. Yes, when you'll get that offer, that they want you. This is not an accident. They chose you for a reason. So just get out there and do it.
I love that. I think that's great. So before we wrap it up, one of the things when I was interviewing your friend Robin, and she mentioned to me that you are the female coach for a male rugby team, right?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work? How does that go? And not because you're the female and they're the male, but usually, and especially because rugby, so I think all sports are competitive, but obviously rugby being very competitive, you know, and going in there, how do you do that? How do you lead? Do you lead like you do with anybody else? Or is this, you lead in a certain way because it's a group of men?
I think that the way that I lead is probably very similar. So the team that I coach actually represents the United States Navy at the Armed Forces Championships every year. So I'm proud to say that we have a silver medal and a gold medal in the last 2 years. And yes, I'm very proud of that. And I don't think I change my leadership style because they're men. I think that because I formerly served in the Navy, that establishes a level of commonality. And they also know that I invest a lot in being a good coach in terms of knowledge and exposure and being a student of the game, that they know that when I make a recommendation or I put things together, that they know that it's from a level of competence and depth and investment and understanding, where it's not a matter of me being female or male. We've seen sort of what we have been able to do together as a team. And even though I still get situations where people at the tournament will think that I'm the athletic trainer or I'm the manager, and it happened at a tournament when I was in Grenada, when I was being interviewed, actually, said, oh, so you're the manager of this team? And it was a separate men's team, not the Navy team. But, oh, you're the manager? I'm like, no, I'm the head coach. And it's just one of those things. One by one, people will recognize that the dude with the whistle may not always be the head coach, and there could be a chick with a whistle wearing a bucket hat and a skirt, and that's perfectly okay. That coaches come in all shapes and sizes, and it doesn't matter if you're male or female. It's about how you're able to lead the team and get the team to where they can go.
I love that. You're breaking barriers. It's like you don't let anything stand in your way. I love that so much because I think it's needed. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I do have a hype squad behind me, so...
I know that helps most definitely. So, Koma, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you, where could they find you?
You can find me probably on LinkedIn, Koma Gandhi. I'm kind of on social media, but not really. I do tweet every so often, but my handle there is Gandhi Coach. So I would be happy to chat with folks. LinkedIn is probably the quickest professional way to find me. And if you find me on LinkedIn or Instagram, it's probably going to be something rugby related. So in any case, that's where you can find me.
Awesome. I love it. And thank you so much for joining me today. I know the audience is probably loving this conversation. Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
All right, you guys. Oh, sure. Sure. All right, you guys. I'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you for joining today. For more information on Tracy and her programs and to set up a discovery session, email business@tracycrossley.com. That's business@tracycrossley.com, and go to tracycrossley.com to get your free download entitled Stop Your Inner Dictator. Thank you for tuning in to Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders.